This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Ellich, and this is Skylines, the Cinemetric Podcast. Actually, you know what? This week, that's kind of only half true. This is another one of those episodes where I'm actually going to put out an episode of someone else's podcast on which I appear to talk about what is, to be fair, a cinemetric-y topic, which I had talked about doing an episode here, and we decided we'd do a crossover. That was several months ago now. This episode, as you'll see from some of the very topical references within it, was actually recorded in late September, I believe. But it's an episode of a podcast called The Zeitgeist Tapes, which is put together by Emma Bunnell, the writer and activist who a while back came on the Skylines to talk about history of local government, and by her co-host, Professor Stephen Fielding, as a politics professor at the University of Nottingham. And mostly we are going to talk about, or we did talk about, mostly the subject in question that is one of my favourite BBC dramas, I think, called Our Friends in the North, which if you haven't seen it, then well, the whole thing's going to be a bit mystifying to you. But if you haven't seen it, I really suggest you stop this right now. I mean, stop everything. In fact, stop work, stop your social life. Just go and sit down for 9 hours and watch Our Friends in the North. I'll give you a quick précis. It stars Christopher Eccleston and Daniel Craig, Mark Strong and Gina McKee, among others. The story starts in Newcastle in 1964. And goes all the way to 1995. You see these characters, these four characters, over 30 years of their life, during the course of which we get a lot of stuff about the history of the Labour Party. There's a lot of social housing policy in there. There's a lot about the decline of Newcastle and the North in general. So you can kind of really see why this is the ideal cinemetric drama. I first watched this, not on broadcast actually, I first watched this in about 2003. And firstly, that did very strange things to my mind, because having, me watching this drama in which you constantly have stuff going on in the background, just to remind you which year you happen to be in this time. I was walking around the place and was hyper aware of like news reports about the invasion of Iraq in the background, feeling like I was in the 2003 episode of my own life. That's probably a rather personal psychosis there. But anyway, when I first watched it, I managed to watch it something like three times in the space of about a year and a half, I think, because I loved it so much. I mean, it is fundamentally about Doctor Who and James Bond growing up together in 60s Newcastle and trying to form a rock band. Where can you go wrong, really? But yeah, as I say, it's something I've been talking about doing a Skyline special on for a while, possibly with the New Statesman guys, because obviously it's also a piece of pop culture, so we could have got seriously involved. It's about the Labour Party, so we could have got Stephen and Helen from the main podcast involved. But in the end, went a different way, decided to do this thing with Emma and Steve for the Zeitgeist Tapes. So most of this episode is really just that. It's a very long and nerdy conversation about the drama, about social housing policy and police corruption, and cities. Before we get to that, though, I did realise, as I sat down to record this, that this is kind of our birthday edition. You know, it's I think the first episode of Skylines came out on I think February the 6th, 2016. It's February 1st as I record this, so this is as close as we're going to get to our sort of second birthday edition. For the first birthday edition, Stephanie was still around, so I got Barbara back, my original co-host, and I was got Roy Field, who produced the early episodes. Roy Field Brown came on. You know, it's just a proper sort of celebration. This time, it's well, as you get older, you don't feel the need to celebrate all your birthdays in the same way, do you? You know, but anyway, thank you all for listening to this nonsense and staying with us. As I think I've said before, there's more of you listening to this than I sometimes think we deserve. And I do appreciate that. It's always sort of nice when, in political conference season last year, a number of people came up to me to tell me they listened to the podcast. And yes, it's nice to know that you're out there. So do feel free to get in touch. It's kind of, you know, I'm, as you've probably noticed by now, I kind of have a very fragile ego, and it's always kind of nice to know people are paying attention to my rubbish. Anyway. From here on until quite near the end of the tape, I might come back at the very end, but from here till quite near the end of the tape, it's going to be an episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes from last October. Obviously, it would be remiss of me at this point not to mention that you should subscribe to the Zeitgeist Tapes as well, and also follow both Emma and Steve on Twitter. Anyway, let's take it away. Mm-hmm.
Dice Tapes. This is a regular monthly podcast hosted by myself, Emma Burnell, and Professor Stephen Fielding. Hello, Steve.
This is Professor Steve saying hello, yes.
Hello. And we're delighted this week that we're joined by journalist John Ellidge, who is the editor of the City Metric blog for The New Statesman. Hi, John.
Hello, how are you doing, Emma?
I'm very good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. Very excited about Labour conference this weekend, as you know, as you would be.
Absolutely.
So that's going to be wild.
A week by the seaside, that's how I'm looking at it. So we have a few things that we wanted to talk about this week, this month. But the first thing is our very exciting contest that we ran over the weekend on the Zeitgeist Tapes Twitter, which was the World Cup of Political Television. And, we got lots and lots of people getting involved. We had lots of people voting. We started with 32 different shows, so I won't name them all here, but you can go onto our Twitter stream, at ZT Podcast, to have a look. But the final boiled down to quite an interesting contest, particularly given current times, between The West Wing and The Thick of It. So we had a contest between what you might call American idealism and British cynicism, in which it's quite fair to say that the final result, American idealism, took quite a big hit. The Thick of It winning about 66% of the final vote, I believe. So did the right show win, John?
I don't know. I'm not wild about this, I have to say. I think maybe because I'm such a cynical soul the whole time, I quite like the idealism of the West Wing. Some of the early stuff kind of grates, it's dated pretty badly and grates a little bit when they're all sitting there saying God bless America and you'll throw up. But generally speaking, I do much, much prefer the West Wing. I found The Thick of It a bit too depressing precisely because I suspect that's exactly how it works.
See, I'm somewhere in the middle, I have to say. I like both shows. I think they're both great shows. I watch them, rewatch them regularly. But I think the reality lies somewhere between the two. People are generally better than they come off in The Thick of It, but there ain't no way as good as they come off in The West Wing.
No, but I do kind of, I do sort of think that people don't generally go into politics for entirely selfish reasons, because if you really just want kind of like money or glory or something, there are much, much better ways of getting
that.
Well, you're not going to have to sort of deal with like members of the public calling you all sorts of names every 5 minutes. I just don't see, I don't quite buy into this purely cynical view of politics. I think there is an element of idealism from people on both sides of the fence, really.
Oh, no, absolutely. I completely agree. I mean, and that's why, as I say, I think I fall somewhere in the middle of The Thick of It and The West Wing. I don't think... I think The West Wing is overdone in its idealism. And when they make mistakes, they don't even make them for good reasons. You know, there is very little cynical calculation, of which there is a bit in every walk of life. But I don't think that it's anywhere like as bad as the Thick of It. And I think The Thick of It is possibly quite damaging to the way that people view politics. Steve, what do you think?
I do think The Thick of It is quite damaging in actual fact. And if more people actually watched it, it would have been quite damaging. Because I was always surprised by how few people really did actually watch it. When it went on to BBC Two in the last two seasons, it never made the top 20. Of BBC Two programmes, Dad's Army and gardening programmes and all that kind of stuff were more popular, which meant that less than 1 million people were watching it a week. And I thought until then, everybody was watching it because everybody I knew was watching it. And so in a way, I think The Thick of It appealed to people that liked politics and knew that it wasn't really all like that. And they were mostly the ones that were watching it. And, it was a very Westminster bubble kind of a thing. But ultimately it was extremely damaging to how, if people from outside saw it and thought, is this a reflection of how politics is? And everyone was so one-dimensional as well. I mean, the one thing about The West Wing, obviously it was an hour-long drama, whereas The Thick of It was only for half an hour. But at least in The West Wing, the people within the White House, of course, they were very idealised. But people outside, the people that they engaged with, often, those Republicans that they had to deal with, that, there was nuance. Not everybody was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And so there was, like I say, there was some nuance in it. Whereas in The Thick of It, the Tories were I mean, we all assume it was, you know, based on New Labour.
Yeah.
The people inside, they were deeply cynical. The people outside, the Tories, they were all deeply cynical. You know, there was no nuance in it. It was like a one joke show, and the jokes were quite good up to a point. The swearing was brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, beyond any question, the swearing, you know, was great. And some of the phraseology was great. But it was a rather simplistic kind of take on politics. Everybody's a liar. Whereas the West Wing, yeah, I mean, it all came from a sort of patriotic liberalism, a belief in the possibilities of the American Constitution. But not everybody was an angel. Certainly outside the White House, anyway.
See, I kind of feel like we talk a lot about the damage that the West Wing idealism has done to... I mean, like I've heard it said that the episode Let Bartlett Be Bartlett did a lot of damage to Ed Miliband by making him think that Let Miliband Be Miliband was a solution rather than just kind of amplifying the problem.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I think we don't really talk about the damage done by something like The Thick of It, where I think it did kind of...
Mm.
Lean into that idea that a lot of people have, that, you know, politicians are all inherently cynical, inherently out for themselves, and they're just trying to avoid the next crisis and get the next rung up the greasy pole. And I think, you know, both versions of politics can be damaging. There are times where you probably do need both of those, you know, but yeah. At the same time, both can do a lot of damage.
No, absolutely. I have to say, I've written about this in the past. The problem with the West Wing, for me, it's not the West Wing, the show, which I adore, and I listen to the West Wing weekly religiously, and I enjoy it completely. But the amount of 20-something young men running around in, I don't know, Ulverston or Bolton, who think they're Josh and Toby, and you're just like, dude, get over it.
But that's not the fault of Aaron Sorkin. It's the audience. Sometimes the audience is terrible. You know, the audience takes from things, all kinds of things that the people that make the thing don't want them to. So I think that's a bit unfair to blame Aaron Sorkin for dweebs going about in politics trying to glamorize themselves. But I know what you mean. I mean, I was the only time I've ever been in Number 11. I was at a seminar and people were talking about, you know, Leo as if he was a real person.
Yeah,
you know,
they
were saying anecdotes on the show like they were exemplifying real life.
No, I think that's absolutely true.
There are issues.
And the amount of times that you just get told that The Thick of It is New Labour and it's a documentary, really. That is a much more damaging thing. And I think much more intended by the makers.
Mm. And the thing about The Thick of It is there is no hope. And now I know it's a comedy, and you know we don't want to set this bar too high for a comedy, but it was, you know, it does have political things to say, and Iannucci does have, you know, have a political platform, and he has spoken about politics, and even ironically, I think in 2017 he was saying people should overcome their cynicism and go out and vote, which I thought, well, that's remarkable given your track record. But there is literally no hope. The people are stupid and over demanding, the politicians are craven, the spin doctors are domineering and only looking from one crisis to another. And nope, there's nobody who's any good. Now obviously in the West Wing everybody's good, but at least there's some hope and possibility that things, you know, politics isn't just a cesspool, without, you know, going over into the completely naive thing. But yeah, The Thick of It, there's just nothing there other than this deep cynicism that politicians are all about lying.
I think also both shows are very much of the time. Like, there is a danger in the permanent now we live in with Netflix and so on, in sort of starting to take these things as kind of having universal applicability, whereas actually The Thick of It was basically about New Labour and, to a lesser extent, the coalition years. You know, the world moves on. Like, early West Wing makes a lot more sense when you remember that it was created in the late 1990s when the US was like the only global superpower. It was unchallenged. It was the Francis Fukuyama end of history stuff. And you know, 2 years in, 9/11 happens, and it takes about 18 months for the West Wing to work out how the hell to deal with that, because it doesn't fit in with the kind of optimistic view of the future it's pushing.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some really dark episodes in the West Wing when Bartlett first commissions the military to take out a terrorist. Now, we're meant to think that's good because we're patriotic Americans, you know, watching the program. But he had, you know, there are moral issues which the program raises about whether that's right or wrong. And they ultimately decided it was the right thing to do. But it does, even the West Wing has some complexity to it. Whereas the thick of it, it's just everybody's allying, you know, just after their own careers.
They did give Malcolm quite a good ending, though, in the thick of it. His final speech to the Leveson Inquiry, whatever it was called in the show, you know, actually was that nuance that we've been seeking. I mean, it was only one moment, but it was quite cathartic, I think, for a lot of people in politics who'd felt slightly hard done by the show.
No, I completely agree with you there. That was really interesting, the way that they ended it, when he basically said, because he was basically on trial for being Malcolm, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And being the arch spin doctor, the evil villain, and he turned round and basically said, well, you're all to blame. You know, I do this because this is what you are. This is what you want. Mm. And so it was like an omni culpa. And I thought that was good. But that was the last gasp of it, wasn't it? It didn't really underpin the rest of the preceding show.
Yeah, no. Well, I think we should probably end this there because we are likely to go into a more deep dive on these shows at another time. So I don't think we should say everything that we have to say at this point, given that this is not the focus of this particular show. But I would just like to take this opportunity to thank everyone who got involved with the World Cup of Political Telly. It was great fun to do, and we may well do something similar again in the future, so do look out for that. Do follow us on Twitter, we are at ZT Podcast, and do keep in touch. And you know, we're always really happy to hear everybody's opinions on what our opinions are, however rude you may wish to phrase that. We only block when you swear at me. You can swear at Steve all you like.
Yeah, thanks.
Could I
just say, however, that whoever voted for Boss, well done, because I think Boss should have won, because Boss was the best. I think of those that were in the 32, Boss was the one that really should have won. It's really, really good, and it's a deeply cynical take on American local politics. I think that was something that really was good to get in there, and it should have won.
John, do you have a coulda, woulda, shoulda?
I mean, I think we're going to talk about mine in a minute, aren't we?
We have that too.
I'd probably pick out. Yeah, so there you go. I've given you a segue. How about we talk about our friends in the North?
What a good idea. So yes, this week's, I keep saying this week, this month's focus, I'm going to make you do this weekly one day, Steve, just so that I don't sound like an idiot when I say that. So this month's focus is our friends in the North, so which we're going to hear a quick clip of now.
50 Tory MPs on the payroll of lobby groups so far. That's what we found out. How about you? You talk to your friends in Fleet Street? I just can't get excited about all this, eh? Look, there are bent MPs on the take. What else is new? You'll never prove anything. They're much cleverer about it than Edwards and Seabrook ever were, and nobody cares anymore, Eddie. Nobody expects anything better from politicians these days.
I should have known better. You've always thought this place was a sham anyway. Well, I expect better, Niggy. Turns my stomach to see what's happened to this country. The Tories have turned the whole place into one gigantic nothing shop. This lass came over here to learn all about the Mother of Parliaments. Well, it might be the Mother of Parliaments, but the Tories have got their hands up her skirts. Sorry to be crude, Francine. So, you're not interested. Fair enough.
What I'm really saying is this. As far as I remember, you came here to get houses built, to attack poverty, to speak up for people who have no voice in the world. And what are you doing? Getting pissed in the bar and playing the same irrelevant political point-scoring games as the rest of the wankers in this place. I mean, is this what it's all about for you now, Eddie? Sticking your tongue out at the Tories? It's pathetic.
So, John, this was your suggestion, in fact, that we cover our friends in the North. I think it came from when I was very kindly invited onto your Skylines podcast, which everybody should listen to. So what is it about this drama that you love?
There's a lot of different elements to it that really sort of grabbed me when I first watched it at a relatively formative age of like 22, 23 or something. But firstly, it's It's epic. It takes place over 31 years. It's the first thing I saw where you kind of really get to see kind of characters grow and change and fail on that kind of time scale. There's a lot of different elements to sort of political storytelling. So there's plots about housing policy. I'm a sucker for housing policy.
This is you and me.
That's a big,
this is you and me geeking out on housing again.
but you know, 60s housing policy is a big thread, as is police corruption, as is local government and the sort of the struggles of the Labour Party in the post-war years. And plus, it's got some really great characters and really great acting in them. It just had a depth to it that I think was relatively unfamiliar on television at the time when it was first broadcast in 1996. It's quite sort of theatrical in the way there's kind of like every line, every scene has a point to it.
I mean, it's an astonishing who's who of British actors and actresses. I mean, the secondary characters, people like Eddie and Felix, are themselves, you know, really, really great, played by incredible character actors. I have a little shout out to one of the characters who plays the wife of Tosca's mate, who just turns up, who played my favourite ever character in Emmerdale. So I was just like, oh, I'd forgotten she was in this. So that was a lovely little gift, like an Easter egg for me. The cast is extraordinary. And I think, as you say, the sweep that it has, it's so ambitious. And you know, to a large extent, difficult. It actually lives up to those ambitions.
Well, I'm old enough to remember seeing it when it came out in 1996, and it made a tremendous impact at that point in time, because part of it is contextual, I think, in the sense that it came out just as the Conservative long period of Conservative government was ending. New Labour looked fairly inevitably that it was going to form, you know, the next government. There was, you know, talk of all these various changes that were going to happen and moving away from Thatcherism, and Our Friends in the North comes in at that point, and it starts in 1964 with the characters, or at least some of them, particularly Nicky, say, you know, looking around him, and it's 1964, it's coming to the end of a Tory, long period of Tory government, and Labour, led by a new, young, dynamic leader who's promising a new Britain, is apparently going to take all before it and change Britain. And so there were, when it came out, there were lots of echoes, or apparent echoes, between what was being depicted and what was actually happening. And I think that added quite a bit to it. And obviously, when we watch it now, it's rather different, because actually it wasn't a very hopeful series. When, you know, Peter Flannery, who wrote it, was, you know, it was based on a play from the early 1980s, which expanded into this big 9-part series, which was basically about corruption, because it's about corruption. There's four characters, and it was sold, you know, to BBC Two on the basis it was a posh soap, and the characters are very interesting and they all interact with each other. But essentially, politically anyway, it's about corruption in local and national government, corruption in the police, and the hopelessness of actually tackling that corruption through parliamentary politics. It's a kind of an anti-reformist kind of text. So I think that's why it remains an interesting series today, because many of the themes are themes that we sort of still take, you know, as important about politics, about the impossibility of maybe radical change or the difficulties of radical change, and our perception that politics is inherently flawed and, you know, borderline corrupt. So I think it is remarkable, and I can't think of many series, dramas on TV that really deal with that historical period with that kind of political ambition. I'm not saying I agree with it, but I think it's the ambition that I think is remarkable.
I think corruption is hard there, because it's, you know, some of the corruption portrayed in the show is very literal. There's, you know, police corruption, there's corruption in housing policy, where, you know, a private company is literally paying off local councillors to get its deals through. But it's also corruption in the sort of more metaphorical sense, where it's sort of the corruption of ideals, or as people, you know, become older and more cynical and just lose their idealism. So rewatching it in preparation for this podcast, one of the things that really sort of leapt out at me, maybe this reflects having got older since I first watched it, but one of the threads that really leapt out in this time is the relationship between the sort of lead protagonist, Nicky, played by Christopher Eccleston, and his father, Felix, who's played by Peter Vaughan. And, you know, at the start of it, Nicky's a very sort of idealistic young left. He wants to get out there and change the world. And his father is just this kind of miserable, cynical, you know, they're all bloody same, nothing's ever going to change. And basically, over the period of 30 years, you kind of, like, watch Nicky transform into that same kind of character just through his experience of trying to make the world better and being repeatedly knocked back.
But there is that scene in the last episode, because when Felix... Yeah, because you're absolutely right. Right, even right at the start in the early 60s, Felix, Nicky's father, is this deeply cynical figure. And he always talks about the Jarrah March and about, you know, it didn't achieve anything, because he went on the Jarrah March. It didn't achieve anything, so he kind of... is presented as giving up on politics at that point and thinking the Labour Party, which attacked the Jarrah March, was completely useless as well. And you're right, Nicky has this kind of arc where he starts off as a bright-eyed idealist and then he goes through various experiences and gives up and starts to become a photographer. But at the very end, when Felix has got Alzheimer's, Nicky takes him to see a woman who was a young girl while the Jarrah March was going through her village. And she actually tells Felix that he did change something, because he had an he interacted with her father. And then her father said at the end, as they were leaving, you know, going down to London, the marches, that he'd taken from that actually you don't have to just accept being, you know, being oppressed. You could actually stand up and do something about it. And then Nicky turns to his father and said, look, you know, it wasn't a failure. Your life wasn't a failure. It, you know, things can change. And then his father, who is, you know, well gone with Alzheimer's by this point, then just defecates himself.
Yes. Most amazing metaphor, isn't it? Like, he literally craps himself at that point.
He literally does. And that's kind of sums it up a bit, because, you know, there isn't, you know, what did the Jarrah March change? Not that much, but it did change how this person thought about things. And then the response is Felix defecates himself. So it's very dark, but there is some tiny little bit of hope in it that politics, despite all of this corruption, despite all the things that are being shown in it, there's a tiny suggestion that something might change, but it is very, very small. It is basically, and Flannery confirmed it himself, he just said basically corruption is endemic. And, you know, there isn't much chance that anything's going to change. And he certainly didn't think that New Labour was really going to change anything, because he was obviously 1996, New Labour's not even in government, and he's been quite preemptively cynical about that.
Yeah, one of the things I was really struck by watching this time round is the extent to which it predicts the flaws of New Labour. So the character of Austin Donoghue is based on...
T. Dan Smith.
So Mr. Newcastle from the 60s is quite slightly dodgy local government leader. But that's an absolutely amazingly New Labour character, is this guy who, like, puts too much faith in greasing the wheels with private companies to attain actual public goods. Like, he doesn't, as far as we know, massively profit from the corruption he engages in. It is largely about sort of getting housing built and trying to sort of improve Newcastle. And he gets completely stuffed by it. Everyone hates him and he goes to prison.
It's quite an extraordinary... I mean, Austin Donoghue, I think, is one of the most interesting characters in it, because he is slightly corrupt, but he's slightly humanly corrupt, if you see what I mean. And in some ways, the story is, you know, when you open the door to that much corruption, this is how much floods in after it. So he ends up being sort of almost a victim, and certainly a victim of the industry that turns on him. But actually, you get Nicky saying towards the end, at least Austin Donoghue built the bloody houses.
Yes, but of course the whole series is very much anti-conservative. So, yes, Austin Donoghue may be a bit corrupt, but at least he's not as corrupt as the Conservatives. Is kind of an almost predictable line from it, really. But yeah, it's... Austin Donoghue is an interesting character. I mean, the series is based in real events. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of corruption in the 1960s through John Paulson, the builder, and who was depicted in the series, and his relationship with Austin Donoghue, i.e. T. Dan Smith. And the Metropolitan Police was riddled. I mean, certainly the obscene publications lot was riddled with corruption. It's all of it's true. In a way, what I'm not quite sure what what Flannery's trying to say, other than they're all corrupt. And the problem with Britain and British politics is they're all corrupt. Corruption is endemic. He's, none of the characters are able to escape it. Nobody is able to really work in a positive way to change things. Even Mary, because Mary, Nicky and Mary have this on-off relationship that starts the series, and they kind of end up back together again after lots of bumps. But Mary was going off to university at the start of the series. Then she gets pregnant, and so she can't go to university, and she becomes a housewife. But then she comes back and, you know, trains as a lawyer and becomes deputy leader of Newcastle. I think it must be Newcastle, and then an MP. And towards the end, she's identified with New Labour. But so she's kind of a worthy character, and yet she's still tainted by New Labour, because it's, you know, Flannery makes it clear that he doesn't really think New Labour's up to much. That he has one character that says you just like the Tories right at the very end. Mm. So it's kind of hopeless, and in a way, yeah, John's right. He kind of does predict things that go wrong with New Labour, but in a way, that's because he thinks nothing good is ever going to come of anything. So of course, you know, when you look back, you know, we think, well, New Labour could have done this, could have done that. We're all a bit disappointed. Well, he predicted the disappointment, because his basic line is everything in politics is corrupt.
Yeah, I mean, that was watching it, it's kind of difficult to work out exactly what Flannery wants. Mm. Like, he doesn't seem to, he doesn't buy it. He can see that there's a problem with kind of the old left approach to Labour, and that you're going to get completely crushed by the system. But at the same time, he doesn't like any of the compromises necessary. I mean, Mary basically ends up as kind of a New Labour MP, right? Is kind of a subtext there. And the succession of characters tell her how bloody awful she is for it. Like, nobody turns up and says, actually, you know what? You've had a very difficult, you've been dealt with a very difficult hand in life, and you've pulled yourself up to rise to these great heights where people are talking about you as a potential leader of the Labour Party in future. Nobody ever says bloody well done, do they? No one ever says, you know what, actually, you've done really well for yourself. Mm. People just tell her what a terrible disappointment she's been the whole life.
Yeah, I mean, no, the treatment of Mary, I have to say, throughout the show, she is treated either as an adjunct to Nicky or a cautionary tale. The point where Nicky decides to cheat on her, which he does once they're married, comes just after she's had to make a very difficult political decision as a senior counsel officer, where she sets an illegal budget. And it's almost like the writer is basically saying, you deserve this because you had to set, just as you decide to set an illegal budget, therefore it's fine that your husband has run off and slept with someone else. And the scene, she's on the phone talking about this difficult decision that she's had to make. And you see Nicky all upset because he's had yet another row with his dad. And I'm fairly sure that what the writer is supposed to be making me feel there is, oh, poor Nicky, Mary's not focused enough on him. And I'm just sitting there thinking, you selfish sod.
I didn't read it like that at all, because, like, I mean, like, I read it as, like, it's the narrative is far more critical of Nicky throughout than I'd noticed when I was a kid and thought he was the hero.
Because I thought he was the hero the first time round watching it. I was quite surprised by how much I didn't like him this time around.
He's just, I mean, like, something I will always say really has dated well is that, like, kind of the young idealistic sort of blokey lefties are all very, very well observed. It's very, very recognisable.
There's a wonderful moment where he's walking with Geordie, and he's been taking lots and lots of photographs of homeless people. And he shouts at Geordie, do something useful, and then runs into the police, clearly getting his camera confiscated and thus doing nothing useful.
Yeah, they just beat the crap out of him. That's his idea of doing something useful, is running to some police who are going to beat him up, while Geordie just kind of slinks off into the background.
And then that happens again at what is quite clearly the miners getting beaten up. Once again, he gets his camera confiscated. I'm amazed he managed a retrospective of his photography, to be honest.
But don't you think, I mean, because obviously we're talking about Nicky and Mary, because they are the overtly political characters, aren't they? Nicky's the idealist who kind of loses it. Mary is the kind of the pragmatic, you know, she works at it, she gets to a certain position of some influence and being able to do something, but there may be compromises which we are maybe meant to think are unacceptable or not, I'm not too sure. But then there's the other two characters, aren't there, which, like Tosca, who I remember at the time, you know, first time around thinking, what a idiot. And, you know, having no sympathy for him, when he starts off, he's only interested in getting off, you know, sexually with Mary. He's an extremely randy kind of a person with no interest in politics. And he kind of, because he starts off, he's stenciling crepes to break for things that are going to break the embargo on Rhodesia. And he's completely oblivious. He doesn't really care. And then he becomes a small business person. And then he joins kind of on the periphery of the Conservative Party, becomes a Freemason. He's getting all kinds of info about how to buy up dodgy properties to make money out of the DHSS. And then he wants to get into a scheme to make money out of council house sales. So we're not really, you know, meant to think nice things of him. But I think he comes out of it as actually the best character, is in the sense that he's more flawed, but he's more kind of human than most of them. And he also seems to learn much more than any of them, because to go back to your point about the sexual politics, he starts off as being a traditional kind of Geordie male, calls all women sweetheart and all that. And then he ends up with his second wife having a kind of a proper partnership in business, because she basically tells him this is what's going to happen. So in a way, he kind of learns the most, even though he is the most apolitical figure amongst them. And he loses businesses here, there and everywhere. But in the end, he's still there. And he seems to have learned, at least in terms of his relationship with his wife. And then there's Geordie, who is like the working class victim. He's like the working class who doesn't ever appear to know when there's an election, because, you know, whenever there's an election, he says, oh, I didn't know there was an election. Every time. I mean, he kind of makes the point all the time, Flannery, about this. But he's the victim, isn't he, ultimately, of a corrupt political system, certainly of the corrupt police system in London. And I just wonder what you thought about those other two characters, because people normally talk about Nicky and Mary, don't they, when they talk about it, Sue, because they're the most overtly political ones.
John?
I mean, I think the... Geordie is an amazing performance by Daniel Craig, by the way, before he was famous. So it's almost worth watching it just for some of the hair they make him wear during the films of it alone. Yeah, all the bits where he's sat watching strippers with a sort of innocent abroad slash clearly getting turned on. Yeah, but I think the interesting thing about Tosca's storyline is, you're right, he is kind of saved by the love of a good woman, but that's in itself quite problematic, isn't it? I mean, like, because firstly, like, there is kind of a narrative throughout that, like, you know, it's... men need women to save them from their own worst impulses. So Geordie goes off the rails when he's sort of prevented from having the great affair of the love of his life. Mm. Or like Nicky never quite settles down because Mary isn't there for him. It's kind of strongly implied. So the fact that Tosca's life is saved by the love of a good woman is a little bit uncomfortable. It's sort of not really sort of encouraging anyone to take responsibility for their own lives there. The other thing I noticed watching it this time around is actually, like, his good qualities are sort of more there at the beginning than I realised. Like, he is a misogynist, he is a total cynic, he does basically steal Nicky's girlfriend behind his back. But at the same time, like, he's much better with people than Nicky is. Like, one of the reasons that happens at all is because, like, in kind of, like, in that first episode, he's capable of talking to Mary's family and her disabled brother, like, he's a human being rather than standing there thinking he's above all of them, which he does to basically everybody for 9 hours of this thing. So it's not, you know, her running off with Tosca is not quite as irrational a decision as I think I sort of thought it was when I first watched this, when I was a 22-year-old idealist who kind of thought that the sun shone out of Nicky's ass, basically.
yeah, I think that's fair. I think Tosca does grow. I think he's the only one, really, that is allowed to grow in some ways. Mary almost shrinks. Maybe she grows in the middle bit, and then by the end she's a sellout. And there's also a very odd scene where she seems to be acting as lead social worker for this one child in her constituency, at which point I'm like, do you have any idea what MPs actually do? Because the whole sort of blaming her for the death of Sean is quite extraordinary, really. But Geordie's ending is very odd. Geordie walks along a bridge, and that's good. That seems to be the entire ending that we get for Geordie. Nicky and Mary, we assume, end up together. Tosca has the loveliest ending where Geordie sees him and the family that we weren't sure him and Elaine were going to have playing together whilst celebrating their night of success where Tosca got to achieve his lifetime ambition of being in a covers band.
But what did you think about the Collinson family? Because Felix and I forget what Nicky's mother's name is, but Nicky's father and mother are kind of become victims of these juvenile delinquents. Mm. And Christopher Collins in particular, who is himself the result of a family of uncertain provenance. You know, his father's run off. There's some other blokes in the household. His mother seems to be, you know, unable to control anything. And then Christopher Collinson has a son, Sean, who is the one that the MP, as you say, chairs a social services meeting about, and who ends up driving a car into a wall because he's, you know, his father has rejected him. His mother's gone off somewhere. I mean, I was wondering, who are we meant to blame for this? Because the whole series is kind of, there's a number of things going on, but one of the themes of the series is the failure of politics to address the interests of the working class, you know, to do something for those people whose lives, you know, are shaped by poor housing, you know, bad jobs, but, you know, whose lives are not good. And the failure of the Labour Party to really do anything about it because of corruption. And the Collinsons seem to be the kind of the expression of that, you know, the result of that. But I'm not quite sure how to interpret it, because there's a debate about, you know, is it structure? You know, is it because of the housing? Is it because of all the cuts in the 1980s? Or is it, as Mary seems to suggest in her New Labour way, because the parents didn't take responsibility, and that then leads to being accused of as being a Tory? So I just wonder how you took that, because that's kind of an important ending, you know, that the working class is kind of out of control. Has it been betrayed? Is this the result of all of that? Or is it just bad parenting? It was just an unresolved kind of an end, even though Sean Collinson drives right into a wall. That's a very definitive ending, but I'm not quite sure what we're meant to make of it.
I think a lot of that ties in with, it's a very overtly Catholic series. Mm. So a lot of the characters are Catholic. We see a couple of Catholic funerals. But there's all this stuff about original sin. So like Nicky is basically living out the doomed to live out the sort of disillusionment of his father over a much longer timescale. I think there is a similar thing here, that there are original sins in the world that you can't fix. I think tied in with that is just something it does dramatize very well, is the fact that it is difficult to deal with social problems. It's not just a matter of of kind of, you know, reaching out and helping people, and you know, with enough funding and better housing, everything can be made better. And I think the series dramatizes quite well the tension within the left, between the urge to kind of idealize the working class and the sort of the tendency to kind of recoil when you're faced with people who are just going to be sort of arsy and aggressive with you. You know, it's like, and a successful left-wing government needs to kind of deal with the latter, rather than just kind of thinking, God, this is ugly, I don't want to be near it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there are, it's the sort of the noble working class versus the actual, you know, the actual lived reality,
yes,
of people who grow up on very, very dodgy, difficult council estates. And I think there is a real tension in the show that is actually quite realistic on that. It tries too hard sometimes to make the noble point, but it never forgets that the Collinses are also human. And when you see, I think Anthony, who is Mary's son and a police officer, but a good police officer, makes the point at the end, you know, this is Sean when he's eight, and you love him and you really care about what's happened to him having lost his mum, now he's 13, you've written him off as a yob. And you know, at what age do we write off these people? And what age do we give up on people? And I think that's a really quite well-made point in the series. I think Sean, in some ways, and I think this is quite deliberate because they bring the two at the together at the end, he's reflective of Geordie, where, you know, Geordie is a, you know, starts off as a young, carefree young man, then, you know, bad things happen to him, and he loses everything and is lost for about a decade of the show. And quite clearly has, you know, strong mental health issues. But at the end, he seems to have come good, and we don't really know how or why, but he seems to have sorted himself out.
No, I don't think Julie becomes good at all. I think, like, there are enough hints in that last episode to suggest that, you know, he's screwed forever now. Like, the bit where, like, we're tossing him in Elaine, take him into their house and give him this a great big bedroom, and he just kind of, like, curls up on the floor and then trashes the room.
I think he's on a journey back from where he was the episode before, where he was quite clearly suffering from severe psychosis. So he's not there anymore, is sort of the point I'm trying to make. The bit where he exchanges...
Someone to support him through that, though, and there isn't anyone. It's very, very... No one's going to stand by him through the difficult...
This is where I find it a bit confusing, because he comes back from the psychosis where he says to his psychiatrist that the Labour Party told him to burn his bed. and he has the lovely line, "I think that's why they didn't win the election," which I thought was amazing, yeah, right? But he's, you know, in that last episode, and we don't know why, he is not suffering from that psychosis anymore. And that is what I mean by he has a better ending. But I think he and Sean, you know, we don't think Geordie is going to go on to great things, but we know that he's not at the pit of despair that he was in at one point. Mm. And for me, I think that's reflected in his meeting with Sean and his sort of strange exchange with Sean. You're quite clearly seeing, here's a young man going through almost exactly the same things that Geordie went through as a very young man. How is this story going to end? Gosh, it's only going to end one way, right?
This really, it's, I mean, that was something I picked up and from it, watching it again, about the fathers. And it may be linked to John's point about original sin and the Catholic nature of it. Because it is subtly Catholic. I mean, it's only halfway through, I think, that it's revealed that they're all Catholics, or they're mostly Catholics. But Nicky's relationship with his father, whose father being deeply cynical and showing him no love, we discover towards the end, was replicated by Felix's own relationship with his own father, who was deeply cynical and showed him no love. And we don't know what, you know, Felix's grandfather and beyond and all of that. Is this because, you know, is there something going back between, you know, men and their fathers, and there's something flawed there? And also Geordie is a victim of abuse from his drunken father. Yeah. And like you know, Sean Collinson is a victim of abuse by his own father, Christopher. We don't know, and Christopher's father has abandoned him, so we don't know what happened there. And I mean, I think the only good father is Tosca's father, who's the baldy guy who plays the drums in the band.
Yeah,
and is an embarrassment to everybody.
But Tosca's family are very explicitly supportive.
Yeah,
like they're clearly like they may be deluded about his musical talents, but they're clearly very supportive of the sound of his ambitions. And you know, I feel in some ways I feel that's not a coincidence that he's the one who comes from the least broken home and ends up. Although having said that, he's still a bloody terrible father to his own kids. So
he is. Yeah,
he's a terrible father to Anthony and Bernadette. But that last scene where you see him in a garden playing with the younger children seems to say maybe he's learned, maybe he's moved on.
Yeah, and also that kind of, because because Mary and Nicky, I mean, Mary's relationship with her own son is difficult, and her daughter, who seems to be okay, she seems to be okay with, she disappears to university, she'll never hear about her again. They have this fractured relationship, which may or may not come to anything at the end. And they are the most political of the characters. And there's Tosca, who is surrounded by this family love. And I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but it seems that, you know, those political characters, they're the ones who are kind of a bit unhappy. You know, trying to get public happiness, they fail, and they don't get private happiness either. Whereas Tosca, who never cared anything about public happiness, in the end gets private happiness. I don't know if he's trying to say anything implicitly or explicitly about politics, but for a political drama, it's highly hostile to politics, I think.
Can we talk about, I mean, going back to the Catholicism element of it, can we talk about how Mary's role in life is basically to suffer and be what other people need her to? Which is, this is something that I found incredibly frustrating on this viewing, but that is, to be fair, made explicit in that awful scene in the final episode where her son just lays into her.
Yeah.
For being, and like, on the one hand, like, the guy is being a complete tit, but on the other hand, it is quite nice that someone's finally said, can you stop sacrificing yourself, stop being a bloody martyr, and do what you want for once in life? And it was almost a relief to find that was a deliberate plot point rather than just the writer thinking that this was the role of the good wife and mother.
Yeah, I mean, I find Mary such a frustrating character because she's quite clearly the one with the most potential and fails to live up to that episode after episode after episode for exactly those reasons. She's, oh, I must put others first. And it's that. And so I found that scene really interesting because while I was like, Anthony, you are not the one who gets to say this, it was actually exactly what I had been screaming at the television for 8 episodes.
And this is where Anthony's just decided to leave his wife and children for completely under-explained reasons.
Yes.
And it's a conversation where it ends up with him yelling at his mother. It's really, you know.
There are a lot of archetype women in the show. So you get a couple of the mums. So you get either the great sacrificer of sort of Nikki's mum, who is perma-suffering. She has so many burdens, and yet she's always a good, cheerful woman. You get the Tosca's mum, who thinks the sun shines out of Tosca. You've got Mary the martyr. I mean, they even called her Mary, for goodness sake. and then you've got Nikki's dreadful posh trot girlfriend who becomes a weird terrorist.
She's an unpleasant figure, isn't she?
She's incredibly unpleasant. The one time Mary actually shows some backbone is when she stands up to Nikki's ex-girlfriend. The problem is of course, you're actually sort of half meant to see that, not as Nikki, as Mary standing up for herself, but as being jealous of Nikki, for Nikki.
Mm. Well, I didn't read it like that. I thought that was like one of the rare moments where you kind of see how Mary and Tosca ever worked as a couple, because they are completely together on that. They're like, you know, they're not going to take this sort of snobby woman up from London kind of sneering at their little life. Like, they kind of do join together and march out together on that. And that's one of the few moments where you actually see them ever operate as a unit.
Yeah, I think partly because it was so unlikely and so hadn't happened at any other point that I felt there was a subtext of this wouldn't have happened if she wasn't Nikki's girlfriend.
Yeah, maybe.
So I think we've sort of explored the stories of all four of the main protagonists. There are some other extraordinary characters who you see coming through this. I think from a political television perspective, one of the key ones would be Eddie, who is the local activist who becomes an independent MP because he's not selected by the Labour Party, which again is a very sort of veiled criticism of New Labour doesn't like Old Labour. And then, of course, gets co-opted almost immediately, which really interestingly, of course, was mirrored years after the drama aired in the story of a certain Mr. Ken Livingstone.
Oh, I think that's a bit harsh, comparing him with Ken Livingstone.
Well, Eddie. I don't compare him with Ken Livingstone in terms of who he is, and he certainly never said anything ridiculous in the way that Ken has been doing recently. But, you know, we don't like you, you're too old Labour, so we won't select you.
Mm.
You will run and win as an independent on the back of that decision. As soon as you do, we will re-co-opt you into the Labour Party and you will become our guy again. That happened with Ken 5 years later.
Yes. But I think, I mean, Eddie is there, I think, to represent, maybe grudgingly on Flannery's part, that there are good people in the Labour Party who aren't corrupt, because Eddie is implacably uncorrupted by all the money that's flowing, you know, to all the other Newcastle councillors to sort of push forward this building project. So he isn't corrupt. And one reason maybe why he doesn't get selected is because he seems to be a bit of a troublemaker, I think, within the local party, i.e. he sticks to his principles. And then when he does become an MP, when he does rejoin the Labour Party, he's not co-opted in the sense that it becomes, you know, strict party line. He wants to change things. And as Nicky says, you know, in that scene, when they have a big round, Nicky said, well, you were elected, you know, you said you were going to change everything. What have you changed? And he's changed nothing. And then when he tries to expose the corruption of the Conservatives in the 1980s with all of those PR companies buying MPs to say nice things in Parliament and to lobby for their various interests, he's stitched up by one of the PR companies. So he's basically silenced and he resigns, you know, decides to retire because he just realises he hasn't achieved anything. And then he dies of a heart attack, you know, in that great big storm in whenever it was, 1987, 1988, yeah, and he dies a kind of broken figure. You know, he is the parliamentary road for the Labour Party, and he achieves nothing and dies a rather sad, tragic death. Which is, you know, Eddie's a very important character, but it's a very negative kind of character, I think.
It's very difficult to point at anyone in this show who ever actually sets out to do something and manages to achieve it. I mean, other than Tosca managing to get rich and then stay rich despite explicitly losing all his money in the crash of 1987, anyone who tries to achieve anything in public life gets repeatedly battered down. Like, he also thinking of, like, even the sort of nice non-corrupt policeman, like one of them goes down for having been in the room where someone was handing out £20 notes, despite the fact we've watched him fight corruption for the last three episodes. Ron Comrade, that's the character's name. And the nice old Geordie Copper, who writes the report on corruption in the Met, and it sends it at like 10 a.m. and it's back at his desk by 11 a.m. because the Home Secretary isn't even going to bloody read it because he and the Met have an arrangement. But like he stands up completely defeated. Like his success in life is in kind of persuading Mary's son that he wants to be a policeman rather than actually sort of achieving anything within the realm of law enforcement. So it's really it's not a show you'd want anyone to watch if you wanted to inspire them to a career in public life, is it?
No, not at all. And because at one level, you could see it, because Paul Foote, who reviewed it in 1996, I mean, the Trotskyite celebrity Paul Foote, said that the series proved that reformist, you know, the reformist road is impossible. You know, a few well-intentioned people trying to manipulate the system to, you know, advance various progressive causes, that can't work. And he saw the series as proving that. But I think the series went beyond that. It wasn't a Corbynite text before Corbyn, even though Nicky increasingly looks like Jeremy Corbyn when he gets his beard and his glasses. I mean, it's really spooky how much he looks like Jeremy Corbyn. But the series, you know, from Flannery's perspective, isn't to say, well, there is a possibility, and it's the left, it's hard left, it's the Benites or whoever, because he shows them up to be, you know, priggish, incompetent, you know, no, they don't achieve anything either, because he's saying something very fundamental and something very basic and something almost pre-political, which is corruption pervades everything, and it will prevent, you know, the people that really truly want to change things from changing things. And then the people that don't really want to change anything, they're the ones that will probably prosper. So it's a very, you know, it would really put you off politics. And it's really quite interesting that people went, because I remember watching it and thinking, oh, Nicky, yeah, go on, Nicky. And it's like you think of it as being about an idealist. And yet there is no idealism except the broken sort, the one that wearily has to give up because it realises you can't change anything.
Well, that's a cheery note to end on.
Not my fault.
I think Our Friends in the North is an interesting text because lots and lots of people in politics absolutely adore it. I mean, it's you know, people are always telling me how much it influenced them to get into politics, which is, as you say, quite surprising when you rewatch it and realise how cynical it is about politics' ability to change anything. But maybe when we were younger and idealistic, we took different lessons from it. Maybe we should ask a young person to watch it. You two are obviously young people, but I'm feeling very middle-aged at the moment.
I think we all are by the sounds of it.
Yes, I think we are. But the interesting one of the interesting things about our friends in North and Peter Flannery is that he moved into TV writing, and he eventually ended up writing, I think, most if not all of the episodes for a series that went on for quite a few years, but I'm not sure made much of an impact on the political class, Inspector George Gently, which was about a detective who moved from London up to Durham in the 1960s, and he confronts all the corruptions which are depicted in Our Friends in the North. It's a kind of Our Friends in the North for Middle Britain in the early 21st century. It's really interesting, and that's kind of mainstreaming many of the themes that we've been talking about in this political drama. And I wonder whether the people who were watching it were thinking of it, you know, in those terms. But it's kind of interesting how that deep cynicism has become mainstreamed into rather comfortable period dramas, which Inspector George Gently essentially is.
Well, maybe that's one for a future podcast. So I think we probably better wrap it up
there,
because we have been going for quite some time. John, thank you so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate that. It's been great to hear your thoughts on Our Friends in the North and its impact on politics, and the difference between our initial one rewatching and the way that different ways that it's made us feel. I think it's really useful sometimes to revisit those texts that we think are so formative.
We should probably all rewatch it again in our 50s and see what it's like then.
Good plan. So, first of all, I'd just like to say thank you to John for joining us. I would also like to say thank you to Lord Stuart Wood of Anfield for our theme tune. Steve and I will be back in a month's time, so do please get in touch on Twitter. We are at ZT Podcast to let us know what you think we should be talking about. And we will be back soon. We gotta get out of this place.
Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday, dear Skylines. Happy birthday to me. I can't help but think that would have been more fun if I still had a co-host. Oh, Stephanie, we miss you.